Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Back in 2021, Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, and a brand new prime minister, Ariel Henry, ended up as leader. Now that gang violence forced Mr. Henry to step down, who holds the power? A warlord named Jimmy, but that most people call Barbecue.
And a tribute to the primatologist Franz de Waal, who convinced the world that animal instincts are not just violent and aggressive, but kind of sweet too. First up, though, it seems that hardly a month goes by without antitrust regulators taking another swipe at big tech firms. Yesterday, it was Apple's turn.
Earlier today, the Department of Justice, joined by 15 states and the District of Columbia, sued Apple in the U.S. District Court for the District of New Jersey for violating Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
The case was announced by U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
As our complaint alleges, Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market not simply by staying ahead of the competition on the merits, but by violating federal antitrust law. Consumers should not have to pay higher prices because companies break the law.
The Silicon Valley company denies all wrongdoing, says that the lawsuit is wrong-headed, and that it will vigorously defend itself. It is the third time Apple has faced legal action from the U.S. government since 2009. Nonetheless, the case marks an escalation in a regulatory onslaught against the once-charmed iPhone maker.
The American government has been building a case against Apple for the past 5 years.
Guy Scriven is our U.S. technology correspondent.
It's finally kind of laid out the arguments in that case. And even though Apple has faced a lot of legal threats in recent times, this one looks like it could be bigger than the rest.
What is the American government accusing Apple of doing?
Well, the Department of Justice argues that Apple has a monopoly in the smartphone market. And it's using this monopoly to essentially kind of thwart competition and undermine innovation, and ultimately this hurts the consumer.
Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers. For consumers, that has meant fewer choices, higher prices and fees, lower quality smartphones, apps.
So the Department of Justice has given several examples of what Apple is doing wrong in its eyes. So one is that it blocks other companies from offering kind of payment alternatives on the iPhone. Another is that it blocks companies from forming what they call super apps. These are apps which have lots of different functions connected to them. So you might be able to watch films and stream music and get your news through one app. And the DOJ claims that Apple blocks these.
Second, Apple selectively restricts access to the points of connection between third-party apps and the iPhone's operating system, degrading the functionality of non-Apple apps and accessories.
It also says that they limit the kind of functionality of iPhone users being messaged by non-iPhone users, and that's to do with the kind of security of the communications. And the DOJ lists a handful of other alleged violations of antitrust laws as well. And it says that this is an example of how Apple is hurting the consumer.
And how has Apple responded to all this?
Well, Apple has said that it will vigorously fight this lawsuit and that it denies the claims. It also says that if successful, the lawsuit would hinder their ability to create the kind of technologies that people expect from Apple, where kind of hardware, software and services intersect. It also says that with kind of restrictive regulations like this, it may lose money. That this lawsuit threatens the principles that set Apple products apart in fiercely competitive markets.
But Guy, Apple has faced legal challenges before. So how significant is this lawsuit?
Well, it does feel like a bigger deal than other antitrust action against Apple. For instance, the stock price of Apple fell a little bit, about kind of 2 or 3% on the news. That is actually quite rare for antitrust news to move share prices. And that's partly because a lot of antitrust cases have struggled and have been thrown out in court. That happened to some of the FTC's challenges to mergers. There's a kind of narrative out there now that a lot of the antitrust cases basically are kind of regulatory overreach. And the fact that this one moved markets means you should pay a bit more attention to it.
So what marks this case out? Why might it be different?
Its remit is essentially broader. It's looking at the conduct of Apple over the past decade or so. A lot of the other antitrust cases, both against Apple and against other big tech firms, are pretty narrow. So, for instance, one of the DOJ's outstanding cases against Google is specifically aimed at payments that Google makes to companies like Apple in order to make Google search engine the default search engine on particular devices. And then if you look at another big antitrust case, which was Epic suing Apple and Google, which has been one of the big antitrust cases over the past few years, that was focused specifically on the kind of App Store and how Apple uses the App Store to its advantage. And so this case is basically a lot broader. And I think the worry there is that it could have broader implications too, and it could affect the way that Apple do business.
What do you mean by that?
So in the event that the DOJ win this suit, it's not really clear what the kind of punishment for Apple would be. That will be decided later. I mean, often in these cases, part of it is at least a fine and then maybe a change to the way Apple operates. But even if the DOJ doesn't win, this still could have a kind of possible effect on Apple's business, simply by the fact that it kind of draws the attention of management away from the day-to-day running of the business. And some people argue that the really big antitrust case in the 90s against Microsoft led to Microsoft missing big opportunities in the computing market, such as smartphones and search. And so these antitrust cases, even if they don't come out with the result the Department of Justice wants, can have a kind of long-term impact on a company.
Okay, but you've said antitrust cases like these have been thrown out before. So what does the Justice Department have to prove here?
Well, in cases like this, you have to demonstrate that first, Apple is a monopoly, and that second, that monopoly power is causing some kind of harm to consumers. And my reading of this at the moment is that that first part of it is going to be a bit of an uphill battle to demonstrate. So if you look worldwide, Apple has about a 50% market share in smartphone shipments, if you look at units sold. So it's certainly not a monopoly there. And then in the US, it only really starts to look like a monopoly if you concentrate on just the most expensive types of smartphone. And there, it has a kind of lion's share of the market, if you look at the upper echelons of smartphones. And I wonder whether that will make its chances of demonstrating that Apple is a monopoly a bit harder. But these are all matters for the court to decide. And any decision on this, anyway, is quite a long way off. Most cases like this run for kind of 3 to 5 years. So this is going to be a long, drawn-out battle.
Guy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
We've made a few changes to our podcast lately, and we're eager to hear what you think of them, particularly if you listen to The Intelligent but have yet to subscribe to our new premium service, Podcasts Plus. If you'd like to share your thoughts, please just click the link provided in the show notes to participate. And thank you. Your feedback really means a lot to us.
One of the more popular kinds of story on our website and in our app is called The Economist Explains. In short, sharp articles, it answers questions, the very kinds of questions you might be asking yourself about big news stories. Stories such as the utter chaos that's engulfed Haiti. Earlier this month, the gang violence that's plagued the country for years got so bad that the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, was compelled to step down.
Haiti besoin la paix. Haiti besoin stabilité.
Haiti needs peace, Mr. Henry said, announcing his resignation on social media. Haiti needs stability. The gangs behind all that violence, that instability, they take orders mostly from one man with an unusual nickname. So who is Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, Haiti's most prominent warlord?
It was supposed to be a mission to secure Haiti.
Hal Hodson is The Economist's Americas editor.
But while Prime Minister Ariel Henry was in Kenya signing a security deal, Haiti's gangs pounced. They attacked two prisons, released thousands of inmates, and laid siege to the international airport, in part to prevent Mr. Henry returning. Mr. Henry has still not been able to re-enter the country. He announced his resignation from nearby Puerto Rico, but despite this chaos, Haiti has not been without authority figures.
Premier objectif bataille noir, c'est assurer nous que gouvernement Ariel Henry n'est pas sous pouvoir encore et que n'importe façon nous-mêmes toutes nèg net en général quel des groupes.
Jimmy Cherizier, a man in his 40s, often called Barbecue, seems more powerful than ever. Mr. Cherizier grew up in poverty in a slum in Port-au-Prince. He's the youngest of eight children. And he says his father died when he was a child and that his mother sold fried chicken on the street to support the family. This, he claims, is the origin of his nickname, Barbecue. Others say the name's origin story is the belief that he sets his enemies on fire. On reaching adulthood, Mr. Cherizier joined the Haitian police. It's one of the few decent jobs in a desperately poor country. But in 2018, the police expelled him for alleged abuses. Those include taking part in a massacre in a slum called La Saline. At least 71 people died in the massacre. 400 homes were burned. Soon after, Mr. Cherizier was taking part in other gang-led massacres across Port-au-Prince. In 2020, Mr. Cherizier founded the G9, a group of nine gangs that has since expanded. They took control of several neighbourhoods around Port-au-Prince. Gangs controlled about 80% of the capital before the latest violence broke out, according to the United Nations. Initially, the G9 allegedly propped up Jovenel Moïse, the president who preceded Mr. Henry and who was murdered in 2021. Insight Crime, which is a regional reporting outlet, reported that Mr. Cherizier's gang got half of its income from Mr. Moïse. But while it might have been expected that with Mr. Moïse's death, Mr. Cherizier would lose power, that did not happen. Mr. Henry was appointed as Prime Minister just 2 days before Mr. Moïse's death. He took over as an unelected caretaker, and the Haitian state crumbled beneath him. Haitians had long been calling for Mr. Henry to step down. And Mr. Cherizier benefited from that power vacuum. He echoed Haitians' calls for new leadership, and in doing so, portrayed himself as a revolutionary, a Robin Hood or a Che Guevara for the Caribbean nation. With Mr. Henri soon to be out of office, foreign leaders are negotiating over an interim government that would hold elections for his eventual successor. But Mr. Cherizier appears to have political ambitions of his own. He is warned that decisions made outside the country will plunge Haiti into further chaos.
Si yo continue nan route yo pral ale la, y a plonger Haiti nan chaos. Lè yo pran un ti groupe politisyen traditionnel.
His group of gangs, Mr. Cherizier says, will be the ones who will figure out how to get Haiti out of its current misery. Throughout the past few weeks, he's been holding press conferences impromptu in the streets of Port-au-Prince.
C'est moun ki nan kase populaire. C'est peuple haïtien en général qui compte ça l'a subi.
He says that working class Haitians should have a greater say about who their next president is than they've had in the past.
Mais ki moun ki pral diriger et mais comment et que pour yo diriger.
It's not hard to understand why Mr. Cherizier's rhetoric might be compelling for ordinary Haitians. Haitians have long been ruled by a dictatorship, then a corrupt ruling class. Outsiders, including the United States, have meddled in what elections they do have. Many are, understandably, suspicious of leaders appointed by foreigners, or leaders like Mr. Henri, who were never actually elected. And Mr. Cherizier's early life helps him bolster that image of himself as a champion of the people.
Mr. Cherizier says fighting with guns is necessary. He says he was inspired by François Duvalier, also known as Papadoc, who was a brutal dictator that ruled Haiti from 1957 until 1971. Mr. Cherizier's brutality is already known about outside of Haiti's borders. He has been sanctioned by both the United States and the United Nations. But he does not look like he is becoming Haiti's dictator just yet. Once a transitional government is in place, Mr. Henri will be able to step down and elections can be organized. A possible security mission authorized by the UN and led by Kenya may arrive sometime around then too. The United States has pledged to help fund the force. But although Mr. Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier will not play any direct part in an interim government, given the strength of his G9 group of gangs, it's hard to imagine him retreating into the background.
When Franz de Waal was doing his dissertation at university, he had to go almost every day to the Burger Zoo in Arnhem because his thesis was on the wars between chimpanzees. There was a big colony at the Burger Zoo.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
Two in particular had a big fight, which one definitely lost, one won, and they both retired sulking to the very high branches of a tree. And as he watched them, something extraordinary happened. One of the chimpanzees put out his hand to the other, and within a minute, they were both down the tree and together in a fork of the trunk, and they were kissing and embracing. Mr. de Waal called this what he took it to be, which was reconciliation. The warmongers had made peace. But when he mentioned this to his tutors, they were really quite angry and put out. Because a concept like peacemaking or reconciliation was a human idea. In those days, which was the mid-1970s, you didn't attribute that sort of emotion to monkeys or to any of the apes. But having seen that, Mr. de Waal was very keen to continue looking for emotions in the other primates, just to see to what extent what humans thought of as their higher nature, their impulse to be kind, to help others, to cooperate and so on, whether that nature was also in primates already. As it was, he was working at a time when scientists supposed that only the worst parts of human nature had come from animals: aggression, violence, selfishness. And he set out to prove them wrong. He realized, though, he would have to adopt scientific methods to do this. He couldn't just have the lucky chance of spotting some monkeys being kind. He had a great sense of humor, and his humor infused a lot of the talks he gave and certainly some of the videos he took of the monkeys and what they were getting up to. He had a famous video that went viral, which was to do with the concept of fairness. He put two capuchin monkeys in adjacent cages, and they had to do a task, which was to hand out stones to a researcher. And when they did the task successfully, they would be given a piece of cucumber. So they did the task once, each of them. They were given a piece of cucumber. That was fine. Then they did the task again, and one of the capuchin monkeys was given a grape instead. And now the other capuchin, who had had the cucumber again, looked at him rather uneasily. But when it happened a second time, he got absolutely furious, and he chucked the cucumber out of his cage, and he rattled the bars, and he was doing all he could to get out and grab the bowl of grapes from the researcher. And it's a very funny video.
And he gets cucumber again.
And that just showed that what we think of as the lower primates were just as keen to be treated fairly as any human was. He looked particularly at politics in chimpanzees, and there was politics there. It wasn't just a matter of having a war until you picked a leader. In fact, physical violence really didn't feature very much in chimpanzee leadership contests. What happened was that the candidate gave food to win the support of other chimpanzees, or he offered the favors of other females. And that way he built up alliances, and it wasn't by any means either the strongest or the biggest chimpanzee who became the alpha male. It was often quite a small one, but one of Machiavellian tendency to plot. There were also other things that he noticed, like the fact that chimpanzees could be very kind to each other. He watched one ancient female chimpanzee called Penny, who was too old to walk, but she'd be helped across the enclosure by other females and even helped up into a tree when they were all gathering there. He saw an extraordinary example of empathy in a bonobo called Cooney, who found an injured bird in her enclosure. And she climbed to the top of the tallest tree with this injured bird in her hand and then spread out its wings to try and encourage it to fly. And on another occasion, he visited a very sick chimpanzee called Mama, the oldest of the group, who was lying obviously very near death and couldn't move. And the moment she saw him, she leapt up, smiling, and embraced him, which of course showed delight in recognizing a friend. So when Mr. Doyle had to sum up his career, he liked to say that he'd brought apes up a little bit and brought humans down. There was always still this tip or veneer of the wonderful achievements of humans which could not be imitated by animals in any way, like the piano music that he loved to play. There were parts of human achievement that obviously had to be treasured and couldn't be imitated by animals. But on the other hand, he equally treasured the scenes he saw when lockdown was lifted after the COVID epidemic. And he saw humans gathering together and just delighting in being with each other, being purely in their primate nature.
Anne Rowe on Franz de Waal, who's died aged 75.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is John Joe Devlin, and our sound engineer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larniuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy, and our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane, with extra production help this week from Emily Elias. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for the weekend edition of The Intelligence.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.